Hello and welcome to Political Heat, the podcast that aims to make sense of climate politics. I'm your host, Amy Mount, and in this episode, I'll be looking at whether power lines are going to be the next battle lines. Regardless of who wins the general election, energy infrastructure could well be a political hot potato during the next parliament. The Labour Party's pledge to eliminate emissions from the power sector by 2030 has come under growing scrutiny. It's being attacked as unrealistic by the governing Conservative Party, but they in turn have set their own target just 5 years later, 2035. Both targets imply substantial new clean capacity for generating electricity, as well as the power lines necessary to connect it to consumers. It's one reason, alongside the ambition to build more houses, why the Labour leadership has adopted a punchy position on planning reform. Keir Starmer promises to stand with, quote, the builders, not the blockers. Here to explain why the power sector is so important and to help us understand what's needed to get emissions down to zero is Emma Pinchbeck. Emma is Chief Executive of Energy UK, which is the country's largest energy trade association and represents more than 100 suppliers, generators and service providers. I've known Emma since she worked at the conservation charity WWF as head of climate, and from there she moved to the Renewable UK Trade Association before taking on her current position. As this career path shows, she has a real passion for making progress on climate, and she combines that with a detailed understanding of the role that energy businesses can play in the net zero transition and what they need from policymakers. Emma, welcome to Political Heat.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, I remember it seeming pretty significant when you were announced as the new leader of Energy UK. Your previous roles were championing renewables, which at the time had maybe a somewhat insurgent status in the wider energy sector. Do you think your appointment signalled a new direction for the industry? And how did you feel about it being seen in this way?
Yeah, I think it absolutely did, certainly in my own head, because the move up to chief exec in a visible role working on issues beyond climate change were all quite personally big challenges. But I was really worried about what the environmental movement would think of it, because Energy UK is a kind of incumbent industry trade body. We've got all technologies. It's specifically not a net zero organisation. And I think the fact that they came looking for me explicitly and were keen to persuade me to take the job, and the fact that I took the job, tells you that broadly what the power sector and what the energy sector are trying to accomplish is in line with what we were arguing for at WWF and is in line now with the UK carbon budgets. And in some ways, the private sector is now ahead of where government is. And I think the biggest shift has been in the 10 years I've been doing this, away from it being a green agenda pushed by environmentalists against the interests of the economy or, you know, kind of traditional business or perceived that way, to being something where business is driving the agenda, not just because they understand climate risk and they understand the environment and they worry about the children, but also because the new technologies are where all the future of the energy system is and where their future profits are. So it's been a great joy doing the job. And the other reason I took the job, and we might come on to this, is that it links big infrastructure change, what's happening with technology development, with ordinary people, how we pay for energy, how we use an essential service, how we experience the energy transition. And I thought that was a deeply powerful thing.
And you mentioned some of the challenges that you anticipated going into the role. What were they? And has it been as maybe difficult as you thought it was going to be?
The biggest thing was obviously that I've sat on the other side of the table from large corporates giving them a hard time, particularly in the job at WWF, where if you're in the environmental movement, your only job is to speak truth to power. That's the kind of NGO civil society catchphrase. But you look at the science, you look at the carbon budgets, you look at what needs to happen, and you go and hold powerful people to account. And some of those powerful people are now in organisations that I work with and represent. And I was really clear in the interview process that nothing I'd ever said previously would be undone by taking the job, and nor would I ever say anything out loud in public that wasn't in line with UK carbon budgets or my previous record. And they have been extremely pragmatic about knowing that, and I suppose vice versa. You know, you have to have quite honest conversations about this is what I've said before on these issues, this is what we believe. Just in practical terms, they were very, very up for Energy UK becoming a more mission-led organisation, so the trade body having a view about what the future energy system should be. So net zero is now something we explicitly work on. and they have given us a large amount of space to be ahead of the industry on some issues, trying to lead them, talk to them, get them more comfortable with being even more ambitious than they already are. And part of the conversation about hiring me as a former campaigner was that they would want to use that skill set to help them in a inside the tent way rather than just on the other side of the table way. But it was all around that. You know, I've got a very clear track record, and you can imagine that for some folks in the sector, it's an unusual thing to be thinking about having a former climate change campaigner as your key representative in government and to the wider public. But it hasn't been a problem in the job, actually, at all, ever.
Right. So instead of what you typically expect of trade associations, which is they stand up and channel the voice of the industry, there's much more of a dialogue going on between you as a platform that's interfacing with government and then the members that you're are paying fees, they're yeah. paying your wages, aren't they? But that sit one step removed often from the work of government and policy.
Yeah, you can be, obviously you can do a very traditional lobbying job if you're a trade body chief exec. You can aggregate the views of the corporate interests you represent and you can take them in a relatively unfiltered way to government. And if you're a good campaigner, that might work for you. I suppose my experience has always been that government wants added value. They want to really understand an issue. And for me also, I'm not a really big believer in PR without substance. So we have an expert policy team of our own at Energy UK, expert campaigners, folks with a really deep knowledge of both the sector and policy issues. And we often form a view on something and then we work with industry to test, challenge, adapt, amend that view. And so by the time we go to government, I like to think of us as having the commercial take on a set of policy issues and to be translating between those two worlds. This is what you're trying to achieve, government. This is how it would work in the private market. Private market, this is what you're trying to achieve. This is what the government expects you to do societally or economically. And there's some risk to the industry in us being that way, but I think they see that we are more likely overall to get stuff done if we are able to form an independent and substantive view of the world. And certainly I wouldn't be interested in the job if it was just a PR thing.
Okay, so a lot of the UK's progress in cutting emissions so far has been due to changes in how electricity is generated. So we've been phasing out carbon intensive coal and ramping up clean wind and solar. Why was it important for the net zero transition to start with the power sector broadly?
The UK carbon budgets are really smart. They're smart because they break down a kind of abstract, long-term, decades-on problem into 5 yearly chunks, broadly in line with the Parliament, but also that they went from easy to hard across the economy. And the reason we started with power is basically it's much easier to invest in large-scale infrastructure to get private sector to innovate in large-scale infrastructure and to change over a few power stations than it is to try and get, you know, 11 billion people to change over how they are using energy day to day. So, and the technology was just also more established. The first wind turbines that were put up in the UK commercially are about the same age as me. I'm not going to tell you how old that is, but I'm not that old. It's in, you know, it's, we already had technologies that were ready to be scaled to the market. And so we started with power because of technology readiness, because it's easier to change a few big things than it is to change an entire system. I also think politicians like standing in front of new shiny things in hard hats, and we've got a plethora of that in the power sector.
All the great photo ops.
Which is, I'm serious, is, you know, politically it's much more palatable than trying to get people to make changes in their homes. That is at least the political understanding of what's easy and difficult. I disagree with it a bit, but for politicians, it's true that turning on a brand new wind farm is a more exciting photo opportunity than standing in front of a smart meter.
And it's also the case that as we decarbonise the economy as a whole, we're going to electrify a lot of processes
yes.
that didn't used to be electrified. So actually, if you can get the emissions of electricity down to zero, that means that all those other processes, whether that's like industrial processes that are switching from maybe a fossil fuel input to an electricity input, are then zero carbon as well.
Yeah, it's the backbone for the rest of decarbonisation. You're absolutely right. So if you drive an EV, your EV becomes that much greener as the power mix that you're charging your EV with becomes greener. And so it's fundamental to everything else we're trying to do. And a lot of decarbonisation is basically electrification plus some other stuff. So you need a lot of green electricity.
And what would a zero emission grid look like? How would it look different to where we are now?
There is a difference between zero and net zero. A zero emissions grid would have to be completely low carbon, zero emissions technologies, which at the moment would be renewables and nuclear plus storage for those technologies. Most of the system models in the UK say that wouldn't be the cheapest system as it stands. And the carbon budgets are predicated on the least cost pathway to delivering net zero.
Yeah, that's in the legislation itself.
In the legislation itself. And fairly obviously, that also helps the transition get public acceptance. You want it to be as fair and as low cost as possible. And so the idea is that you would also have some net or abated technologies. And in the UK context, that means we need some flexible generation, like gas-fired power stations, or at least that behaves like gas-fired power stations, with either carbon capture fitted to it, so existing gas technology with something that captures the emissions, that's the netting bit, or we have some kind of hydrogen or clean gas going into a gas-generating turbine. So that is necessary, we think, in the UK system for the cheapest system, and also would be a net zero rather than fully zero system, particularly with carbon capture, because you're still producing emissions. And the other thing that's net and different about netting is in the UK system, we think we might need to keep on a couple of unabated gas-fired power stations that can start up in the event of a system emergency. And so
when you say unabated, you mean doesn't have that technology for absorbing the emissions back in and stopping them getting into the atmosphere.
Exactly that, so that we might just burn gas from time to time, very, very rarely, hopefully almost never, when you've got a need to do something that we call Black Start, which is an acronym that I just like saying because it sounds like something from Star Trek, where essentially everything has gone off and you need to jumpstart. Think about jumpstarting a car. You need to be able to start up a complex electricity system with something, and the best technology we have available to us for doing that at the moment is methane gas generation. And so the idea in the carbon budget pathways is that we'd have a couple of unabated traditional gas turbines still on just in case, but everything else be renewables, nuclear, a little bit of gas with carbon capture or hydrogen on it, and then some that we use hopefully not even once a year in the event that we need system security to still operate. And so that's why we say net zero and not just zero. That isn't the case in every energy market. There'll be some energy markets, particularly in developing economies when they're going from scratch, where you could build a 100% renewable system with storage. But honestly, most power systems are going to have that mix of technologies on just to keep them running, to be able to provide power where we need to, and to be able to do it at least cost to society in the time that we've got.
I think it's worth saying that both the governing Conservative Party and Labour are sort of on the same page as what you've described just there in terms of needing some gas generating capacity still in the systems.
Yeah.
And whether we're talking about a zero emission grid or a net zero emission grid, beyond the obvious impact, which is mitigating climate change, how desirable is this transition for the country more broadly than the environmental impacts?
The wonderful thing about this job and the 5 years I've been doing it is I have barely talked about climate change. But the reason for that is it's just become this enormous economic project. And from my desk in the middle of the energy sector, it feels like we're in the middle of an industrial revolution. It is as if we'd gone back 100 years and rediscovered the steam engine. And the price falls we've seen in the global renewables market, the progress we've made in batteries, the consumer interest in electric vehicles, the manufacturing rates for PV coming out of China and other parts of the world have caused this enormous shift in how the sector thinks energy should be done. Because these technologies are cheaper, they're scalable, they offer services and things that we want to sell consumers, flexible tariffs, new products, heat pumps, EVs. There's just this real, I suppose, capitalist interest in the energy transition. And I think that is very good news for the economy. The other thing that's happened is that post the war in Ukraine, there's now an awareness that relying on volatile international fossil markets might be a bad idea, particularly when you look forward to where most of the liquid gas, the LNG and other gas and oil will come from in the 2040s and 50s. And it's in parts of the world which are not necessarily predictably favourable to Western democracies. And I think governments from a national security perspective are beginning to want to have technologies inside their own borders that they can control, because energy is fundamental to the economy. We've just felt that going through an energy crisis. And so since Ukraine, we've had the US Inflation Reduction Act, we've had the European Union's Green Deal, we have got a hydrogen strategy in Japan, which is massive. They're just, every part of the world is now trying to get hold of these technologies and their supply chains. And it's for the jobs and the industrialization and cheap power and services for consumers, but it's also because of national security and that ability to control your own energy system. So very, very rarely do I talk about the environmental benefits of all of this, although there are those too, you know, improved air quality, not catastrophic climate change, all of those things. But it's also a very good story for the economy. And I suppose my best figure on this is that the net zero pathway is now expected to be worth the same value to UK GDP in 2050 as the entire manufacturing sector is today. It's just this huge potential piece of the economy. And I get to sit in the job that's on the front line of that change.
And I think the British public won't have such a detailed understanding as what you've set out from your desk right in the middle of this picture. But I think that does go some way to explaining why in the election it's unlikely to be something that really polarizes voters, because there is just this huge range of benefits to this trajectory.
I also think it's classic Westminster bubble thinking, in that most ordinary people that we can see in our systems in the energy sector. So I've got the energy retailers in my membership, the folks who sell you your power for heat and electricity. And we've got record numbers of people in debt and deepening debt. When we ask them if they understand why that is in focus groups or polls or just customer service centres, everyone understands that this was a gas price crisis. They are worried about that happening again. They understand that gas is volatile. They understand that it's foreign. They understand also that renewables are cheap now. And I think there isn't that resistance to net zero as a kind of climate change expensive thing out there when we talk to ordinary people that you might see manifested in Westminster. I think it's incredibly naive to think that ordinary people aren't hyper aware of energy costs and the causes of a record-breaking gas price spike that means that they can't afford to feed their children.
And this has, I think, changed over the recent years and decades. So when I started campaigning on climate in the 2000s, the main source of controversy, I think, was onshore wind turbines, i.e. those that you find on land rather than out at sea. And although the public was supportive overall, and still is, opposition groups would grow up around specific projects. And these groups tended to be pretty small, but very organised and very vocal. And eventually the Cameron government all but ended onshore wind in England. I do want to come to what I think is a perhaps emerging controversy. Maybe some new fights are brewing around pylons, so around the grid infrastructure needed to connect electricity generators to consumers. Because despite that broad public support, still, when you come to specific places, you can still get these struggles emerging. So could you talk a bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, we have to build a lot of stuff. And I think this is changing in the economy, again, because I think people just across the economy see crumbling infrastructure as a reason that we feel less well off than maybe we did as a country 10 or 15 years ago. You know, you think about housing or the sewage system or the roads. Pick a bit of it, the trains, blimey. I spend my life on trains, and let me tell you, I've got some strong views. So I think people understand that we need to invest in essential infrastructure in order to get the benefits of that economically in a way that maybe they didn't 10 or 15 years ago, particularly a younger generation that's carrying a lot of those costs, or trying, you know, a working generation. I don't think it's a problem unique to the energy sector, but basically what happens is when you try and build something, you get lots of objections. And I think it's really good that we have a strong planning system in the UK. I think it's part of a well-functioning democracy that local communities should have a say about what happens in their neighbourhood. However, it is in the national interest to build a lot of this kit for everyone, for energy bills and for the economy as a whole. And essentially the challenge over the next 10 years is weighing up national and local interest, because it is going to have to be a trade-off. In order to deliver those cheaper energy bills, economic benefits and net zero, we need to build 2 to 3 times the power sector of the one that we've got today to help electrify all those other bits of the economy. We need to build something like 7 times the infrastructure in the next 10 years on the grid than we've built over the previous three decades. There's a massive building programme underway. In terms of what we do about it and how we bring people along with us, you talked about onshore wind. This is a personal view, but I think that the developers 10 or 15 years ago were a bit laissez-faire about local communities. And I think everyone's learned their lessons a little bit in how we engage and work with local people. But there was a bit of that. I don't think that exists anymore, but it's worth keeping an eye on. But what we need to do is firstly have a planning system that designates stuff that's in the national interest as in the national interest and fast track it. It takes us sometimes 15 years to build grid infrastructure. We've got to get this done in three. So there's a need to have a fast track approach for stuff that is really, really critical. There, I think, is a need to build as little as possible. So we need energy markets and incentives that basically minimise the amount of build, and we need to get industry working together to build, say, one cable, not three, and a regulatory system that enables the industry to do that. I can go into more detail, and this is very boring, but just basically, no, we need to build as little as possible to get the job done. The third thing is any community that hosts the infrastructure should be rewarded for it. And historically, we've done things like build sports halls or invest in community trusts, and some communities really love that. Others have had bill reductions from having an onshore wind farm near them, and there's a big consultation going on about essentially how we reward communities for having this infrastructure, because it will be more concentrated in some places than others depending on where the renewables resource is. And then I think lastly, there's a big need to just communicate about why we're doing this and what the benefits are for people, and for politicians occasionally to make tough choices. You know, if you're in a inner city estate in London, you might not be able to have a wind farm near you and get money off your bills, but you will benefit from more wind on the system overall. So it can't be fair for, say, a wealthy community in, pick somewhere at random, Norfolk, to be saying no to infrastructure that benefits you, and or maybe being overly rewarded for it. And so, and that's a political choice that's well outside my comfort zone, but that's the kind of thing we're going to need to see governments getting right over the next 10 years in order to bring everyone with us.
And just to stay on this topic, I think it's one of the terms that often gets bandied around when people are talking about resistance to infrastructure projects is NIMBY, so not in my backyard, which inherently implies people local to the infrastructure saying, I can see there's a need for this infrastructure, but it shouldn't be near me because I have a lovely view and I don't want to spoil that. I think, you know, that's maybe a bit too dismissive of some of the concerns that get raised around new infrastructure, particularly around landscape character in general and the impacts on nature and wildlife. Mm. You used to work for WWF, the pandas. You've got those nature credentials. I mean, does the need for new energy infrastructure have to create a tension between net zero on the one hand and nature or landscapes on the other, do you think?
I think sometimes it will, yes. I realise that's not the answer I'm supposed to give. I'm supposed to tell you, Amy, that we could underground every single cable. There are things that we can do to minimise disruption to nature, and there are very good standards for the industry that they should absolutely be meeting, and we should go as far as we can. So, for example, the most studied bird in the whole of Europe is a predatory bird species that happens to hang around wind farms quite a lot. And the reason for that is
What species is that?
I knew you'd ask me, and I'm trying to think. It's some kind of kite, I promise to write and tell you.
Okay.
But the point about this is raptors are really well studied now because they are required to be studied as part of the impact assessment for a wind development. So there are often now environmental and ecological assessments done in order to get a wind farm built that are providing more information about nature than we've ever had before and more thought about how to protect those species than we've had before. And certainly there are ways to minimise the impact on wildlife. You know, we're talking about raptors. For example, you can paint one blade on your wind turbine black, and apparently it really improves both how it blends into the landscape and whether or not birds go anywhere near them. Fascinating. So we've done, there's loads of things. You know, out at sea, we put things called bubble curtains around wind turbines, which keep harbour porpoises away from them. We have requirements around the noise of drilling in the piles to put wind turbines in to help protect marine species. There's been loads of learning about how we do this sensitively. And on things like cables, we can underground them and so on. And in many sites now, there has been biodiversity net gain, again, measured because the industry is required to monitor and measure it. And national parks and other amenities for nature springing up around things like onshore wind turbines. So all of that is great, and we should do as much of that as possible. And I would love to see every site with biodiversity net gain. That should be what we do. However, there is a cost to it. and we're going very quickly. And in some cases, the cost of undergrounding a cable will be absolutely massive relative to the cost of the wind farm, and someone has to pay for it somewhere in the system, including customers who would benefit from the cheapest power. And I suspect that in some cases where there won't actually be any habitat damage, but there'll be an aesthetic impact, like putting up a pylon, we might just put up a pylon rather than disrupting the landscape to bury it because people don't like their views being interrupted. And that's the thing that the environmental movement might have to grapple with, because environmentalism is inherently conservative. I recognise that in myself. You get into the environment because you are terrified by things changing as fast as they are, because you want to protect and conserve this landscape, this species, this way of living. I think the big threats to our natural landscapes, our special places, our natural species, are often these big macroeconomic global things that we cannot control unless we build some stuff. You know, climate change is the biggest threat to our natural habitats here in the UK, to puffins, to the species I've talked about. We're going to have to build some clean infrastructure to mitigate climate change. That might mean putting a pylon up somewhere that's also beautiful. And that is such a difficult thing to hold intellectually, but it is necessary to sometimes do it. So I come from a really, really beautiful part of the world. I basically got into the environmental movement because I would like the part of Gloucestershire that I'm from to be the same indefinitely and forever. You know, my grandparents have farmed the land there for 6 or 7 generations. That landscape is in my family history, and I would love to pass it to my children. But what I have come to realise is that landscape with a pylon on it is the only way that it might get passed to my children. And so I often think that, looking out at the valley that I live on, would I accept change here in order to protect it for my children? That is the big question for the environmental movement, which isn't to say they shouldn't be challenging us to put bubble curtains up and look after the raptors and do all the things we should be doing. But it is why occasionally we might not underground a cable, we might put it overhead.
And the emerging politics around the power sector doesn't only relate to new infrastructure, although, as you said, there's a lot of politics around that. There is this growing standoff between the Conservatives and Labour relating to their different targets for decarbonising electricity. Why do you think these targets have become front page news recently?
I think we're back to the good old, it's the run up to a general election and someone's decided to make some noise about net zero. And it is a visible point of difference in advance of manifestos being published. And visible points of difference are always the thing that you have a fight about.
I mean, how much of a difference does 5 years make?
I mean, it's not huge. I saw some modelling last week that talked about an extra 400 billion or something entirely mad about delivering for Labour's commitment versus delivering for the Conservatives. And it turned out, actually, when you got into the numbers, it was only a couple of billions difference. And that's, you know, because they hadn't done the counterfactual. No one had modelled, you know, 2035 against 2030. They just modelled 2030. They'd also forgotten to mention that a lot of the money is coming from the private sector. And I tell you this story because actually it's not hugely different. It's just you have to believe things can go even faster than they already are. And there is a slight difference in the technical underpinning. And actually, somewhat surprisingly, the biggest difference between the modelling that was done for Labour's 2030 pathway, I believe, and the 2035 pathway that we're all currently working towards is actually to do with gas. It's to do with this piece about what's the flexible generation to support the renewables and storage. How do we decarbonise that quickly? So it's about getting carbon capture and hydrogen away as soon as possible, or having some other way of managing the system. And I haven't heard much yet from Labour about that bit, but that will be the kind of technical thing to really look out for, rather than say how fast and how many more renewables and so on we're going to do. We don't have a view on this stuff as a sector, because obviously being asked to comment on something that's opposition policy isn't really our job. We work to whatever the government of the day is asking us to do. And currently that's 2035. Were there to be a Labour government, I think the message we've given them is ambition is really welcome, actually. It's really welcome in a global environment where there's lots of competition for the money and the resources. But we just have to go really, really, really fast. So if you're going to do it, let's see some detailed plans and let's be clear about how we get there, not what we're trying to do.
And when the government committed to that 2035 target, that was seen as a big win by climate campaigners, and it really helped to build momentum ahead of COP26, the UN climate talks that the UK hosted in 2021. I wonder why the mood music from the government has changed since then, because I think a lot of the attacks on Labour's 2030 target have been driven by the government, which is kind of inevitable because that's what governments and oppositions do. They attack each other. But it does seem like quite a shift in tone compared to when that 2035 target was introduced.
Yeah, it's been an interesting couple of years. I mean, I know it's a simple answer to a complex question, but there's a general election coming. That's what's different. There is a general election coming. We're at the end of the parliament now. We're not hosting an international climate conference, which we were in the middle of the 2035 debate. And so the political pressure, the Westminster bubble pressure, is pushing in a different direction to where the pressure was pushing several years ago. In terms of the technology, the innovation, the money, not much has changed other than that we are more confident about broadly electrification with some other stuff as being the future of energy. The really worrying thing, actually, as the industry representative, is that the UK government is doing some funny stuff because we've got a general election and politics is politics. And that's fine. We're sort of, it's not fine, it's baked in to the industry's understanding of what happens in the UK. You know, people like me, everyone will have told industry to expect some cracker stuff in the run-up to a general election that may not actually materialise in substantive policy. Just, you know, everyone, let's just see what happens when there's a new government, not through this period. That's fine. However, the not fine thing about it is that whilst we're doing this, every other country in the world is doubling down on their investments into renewables and clean technology because of what happened in Ukraine. So we picked, I don't know, we picked a terrible moment for a general election. I don't know. For my industry, there's lots of places the money could go now. Whereas 10 or 15 years ago, the UK was a market leader in investing in renewables and we were sort of out ahead. We look set to be the bottom of the G7 plus Russia by 2030 in terms of additional clean energy capacity added to the system. You know, everyone is speeding up. So my worry is that the noise becomes something that sends a signal to international investors, and then our energy transition becomes more expensive or delayed because the money's moved elsewhere and we'll have to work to get it back.
Right. So yeah, I was going to ask what impact the party politics has on energy investment in the UK. And it is that sort of, this is all looking a bit messy right now. If I'm an international energy company or an international financial institution looking to invest, maybe I'll go somewhere where there's a bit more political stability and wait out the UK, see what happens.
Yeah, the only thing in our favour, and I'm not sure this is a positive thing really, is that there are so many elections going on internationally this year, including, say, the US, where there is a bit of uncertainty baked in, that we are somewhat getting away with some uncertain messages to investors about our own net zero pathway. And I suppose, just to talk myself out of being thoroughly depressed, we're still talking about 2035 or 2030. That's what the two main parties who are going to form the next government, in all probability, are talking about. Respectively, we're talking about either net zero by 2035 or net zero by 2030. So again, this is rhetoric, not substance. And the fight is somewhat artificial because our two main parties are pretty closely aligned on net zero in terms of the substance. Let us hope that is the case when the manifestos come out.
And aside from stopping the slanging match, which, as you say, is kind of baked into how the industry understands the British government and our political parties, what does industry need from government so that it can make the necessary changes that will decarbonise the grid?
Well, certainty is the thing that I feel we've been screaming into the void about for 10 years, but that's politics for you. You know, industry invests over 25 years, whereas governments work for 5-year terms, and that will always be a conflict, which means people in my job will always be saying, could we have more certainty? Probably hopelessly, whatever the colour of the government and whatever their ambitions. So there's that. If we can't have a utopian world where we plan our infrastructure over 25 years, I think the next thing is having markets that can help the private sector move its money and invest, and which are steady regardless of politics. Now in the UK, the carbon budgets really help us because they're extremely predictable. Our targets are legislated, all of that good stuff. The Committee on Climate Change makes policy recommendations. That governance is really valuable. But underneath that, we have a set of energy markets in the UK which procure these technologies and which day to day procure power for the grid, which are seen as really robust and pretty reliable and well designed. And some of them have been copied globally, particularly our Contract for Difference auction, which is the big mechanism for procuring renewables in this country. But we've got a similar thing called the capacity market for secure supply. So that gets us new gas bill or existing gas on the system. It also procures things like renewables with batteries where they can offer what's called firm power. So things that are a predictable service at times when we need the power for security reasons. We've also got a set of markets which are helping us do interesting, innovative new things, balancing the system and making the use of things like electric vehicles and heat pumps and renewables and the flexible way that they operate. Having those things thought through allows industry to invest. And the reason I've gone through that lengthy description of electricity markets is that we're in the middle of looking at what markets we might need for a very different kind of energy system, and there's lots of options up in the air and being discussed, and that's all quite exciting. The clearer the next government can be about what it wants to do as early in the parliament as possible will really help us kind of get that money in for the next decade.
So ideally this is a kind of first 100 days challenge and then we just get rolling.
Everything's a first 100 days challenge, Amy. There is so much stuff that should be done in the first 100 days, whether it's 2035 or 2030 that we're aiming for, including planning reform. We talked about planning reform and the options for paying out communities. That will need to be done. We've barely talked about grid, but grid is absolute human nightmare fuel. It does take 15 years to get a grid connection. We've got enough projects sitting in queues to get a grid connection to do net zero 1.5 times over or something mad at the moment. Not all of those projects are viable projects, by the way. That's part of the problem. But it's an interesting statistic to tell you just how big the queue is getting. That needs sorting out. We need to understand where we're putting our assets. So where do you want power plant? Where will the cables go? How do we minimise pylons? That means having a new strategic plan. We've got a new thing called the Future System Operator, which will be the control room for National Grid, plus the planning function for this new energy system, plus some other bits, pulled out as a nationalised entity, essentially. It's a hugely important bit of the energy system that is due to be established in April this year, but really get its powers for the new government. The energy regulator has a net zero power now. No idea what that means for how they evaluate things like how many pylons should we put up? Who pays for it? Is that fair? How do community benefits work? What about these new energy markets? And then we've got all of the new energy markets. And so there is an absolute shed ton of work because we're in the middle of the biggest energy transition for 150 years. And it is all gathering pace exactly now in a environment where every other country in the world is trying to get access to these technologies, supply chains, skilled labour and the money.
Okay, final question. How optimistic are you about the road ahead?
Oh, loads. I realise my job is just listing endless problems, but you know, I've got two small humans, very small humans, and I would not have had them. I would not be able to get out of bed every day and come to work if I didn't think that there wasn't a broadly positive narrative here. And the joy of my job, as I said, is that I rarely talk about or think about climate change. The job is about an economic transition that is so powerful. The only question is whether or not the UK is going to get a big piece of that pie or not, not whether or not it's going to happen. And the latest assessment from the International Energy Agency is that just because of the technology development we've made in the energy sector, just because of the costs of solar PV falling, the quality of the technology, the rate of pickup of EVs, the falling off of coal on the global energy system, because of that technology shift, emissions by 2030 are going to peak and decline. Were governments to do nothing else with their global climate commitments, were governments to pass no more climate policy, the energy transition is going to start bending the emissions curve. Now, we can't do it alone. We can't do agriculture. We can't do land use. We can't go as fast as we want to unless governments sometimes get out of the way or sometimes enable those markets. But there is a really, really good story to be told from the technologies that I work on and from the point of view of the energy industry. And so, of course, I'm cheerful most of the time. You have to have hope, but it can't be passive. It's got to be active. And I think there's lots of reasons that we can take action in the energy sector.
Brilliant. Thanks for finishing on that hopeful note. And thank you so much for joining Political Heat, Emma.
You're welcome. So nice to see you, Amy, as always.
Well, that conversation was a real reminder of how far the energy industry has moved in the past couple of decades. It shows how a virtuous circle can emerge. As energy policy supports the growth of renewables, the businesses delivering that clean technology become more visible and their voices get louder. And that means the balance of power, in both senses of the word, starts to shift from fossil fuel companies towards clean electricity generators. And now we have a situation where the power sector is playing a much more constructive part in policymaking for the net zero transition than it did in the past. And while it feels as if there will continue to be a lot of political back and forth about net zero, the direction of travel is clear. The technology and the economics are relentlessly moving in a cleaner direction. The big questions are, how fast will we get there? How many of the worst climate impacts can we avoid? And how adeptly will policymakers handle the political decisions along the way around primarily sharing out the costs and benefits? We will come back to these questions in future episodes of Political Heat, and in particular, we'll hear other perspectives on the political challenges of building new infrastructure, because I think that will be one of the more visible aspects of the transition during the next Parliament. In the next episode, however, we'll be turning our attention to the wider world. I'll be talking with Camilla Bourne about the difference that international diplomacy can make. She has a wealth of experience in this area, and this includes holding the pen on the strategy for COP26, the UN climate talks that the UK hosted in 2021. In the meantime, if you're enjoying this podcast, I'd be very grateful if you would add a rating and perhaps a friendly review. If you'd like to send me feedback, you can reach me at politicalheatpod@gmail.com or on Twitter at politicalheat24. Political Heat was produced and presented by me, Amy Mount. It was edited by Sarah Eldridge. Thanks for listening.